Welcome to the Crimson Threat. I'm John Behrens, pastor of Restoration Messianic Fellowship in the Boulder Longmont area of northern Colorado. Our website is crimsonthread.com. This study was recorded during our normal Tuesday evening Bible study. Enjoy the study. In Daniel, last time, we finished up chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar had been humbled, and Nebuchadnezzar wrote his testimony, which is that God is the one who gives empires and takes them away, and that his kingdom endures forever. Now, we're coming into chapter 5, which is the handwriting on the wall, and I will suggest that as you do that, keep in mind that we're coming off of chapter 4. And the whole thrust of chapter 4 is Babylonian kings acting in arrogance and God grabbing them by the stacking swivel and pulling them down. So I'm just going to suggest to you that chapter 5 is simply a continuation of the same theme that we just finished in chapter 4. So chapter 5. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Right now, Belshazzar is the fourth guy after Nebuchadnezzar. So you had Nebuchadnezzar, then Evil-Merodach and Nergal-Sharezer, and then Nabonidus and his son Belshazzar, and the two of them were co-regents. And as I remember the history, Nabonidus was not really big on being an emperor. So basically he went off and became the Babylonian equivalent of a monk or a holy man. And he was off in some holy city, you know, working on spirituality and all that kind of stuff. And he left the day-to-day running of the empire to Belshazzar. So Belshazzar is in Babylon while his dad is off somewhere else. And the other thing that's going on here is the Medean army has besieged Babylon. And Babylon is a major city in the ancient world. The actual size of physical Babylon is approximately 13 miles on a side. And it was laid out in a rectangle, as I understand it, with the point, you know, one point of the diamond spanning the river, Euphrates. The walls were high enough and thick enough that they used to drive chariots around the top. And it's being besieged by the Persians or the Medeans. The city has a river running through the middle of it, and it was thought to be impregnable. So what's going on with this great feast is Belshazzar is basically sort of sitting there while what he thinks are insignificant little ants are throwing rocks against the walls of his city. In other words, it's sort of an in-your-face kind of an operation. Unbeknownst to him, the royal Persian engineers upstream have diverted the river. And so what they did is they basically switched the river over to the diversion and walked under the gates on the riverbed. So as part of what's happening in this particular story, when it says at the end of this chapter that he died that night, the reason he died is because he was up to his hips in Persians and Medeans. The whole point of this great feast is sort of, we're going to celebrate and have this great feast to show our superiority over the army that's attacking us because they're never going to be able to do anything to us. Having said all that, back to the text. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of the 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Then they brought the golden vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords, his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze, iron, wood, and stone. As you all remember, when Nebuchadnezzar sanded Jerusalem off flat, He destroyed the temple, and he took all of the utensils of the temple and took it back and put it in the temple of his god, I think Marduk. So that's what Belshazzar is trotting out. And again, this is sort of an in-your-face kind of a thing. My gods are more powerful than your gods. What we're going to do is we're going to have a drunken party using the vessels of your gods just to show you how little we think of them. If you take this now on the heels of chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar, you know, standing up on the walls of his city saying, wow, look at this great city I've built, and then God cuts him off at the knees, this is sort of a continuation of the same theme. So now 5, immediately the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand, and the king saw the hand as it wrote. Then the king's color changed and his thoughts alarmed him. His limbs gave way and his knees knocked together. Clearly, this is the description of somebody who has had a bad physical reaction. He is clearly spooked at the supernatural hand that's writing on his wall. It is such that he does not consider it a parlor trick, and he is genuinely frightened. At this point, Belshazzar is, as I say, spooked. And so verse 7, the king called loudly to bring in the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers. The king declared to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Now, when this says the king cried loudly, you've all seen the grade B movies where the king is up against the wall with the good guy's sword on his throat. Guards! You know, it's that kind of a call. In other words, he is panicked. This is not a commanding royal call. This is, come quickly, I need to be saved kind of a call.
Call security.
Yes, call security. Now, when he says, whoever reads this writing and shows me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple and have a gold chain around his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Again, remember that he is the second ruler in the kingdom. So, you know, the normal phrase of doing good to someone from a king is your wish shall be granted up to half the kingdom. And again, that's a stock phrase. Nobody ever got half the kingdom. It's simply an oriental way of saying, I'm really grateful for what you've done. I don't know whether he would intend to make whoever interprets this the third ruler, which is under him or not, or whether it's again one of those oriental turns of phrase that isn't intended to be taken literally. Verse 8, then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed, and his color changed, and his lords were perplexed. Now again, his color changed and his lords were perplexed. He is already ashen-faced. His knees are already knocking. He's had to send out for new linen probably, and nobody can translate this, and he is really upset, and everybody around him now has become upset. One of the things that happens when kings get frightened is people start getting killed. That can be one of the results here. So the fact that this guy is clearly emotionally worked up and getting worse and nobody can help, everybody is sort of backing up and trying to sort of sidestep a little bit and see if we can get either behind somebody else or to the exit, because they really don't want to be around this guy at this point. Verse 10, the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall. Now notice she hasn't been there. She came in. And by the way, the queen here is probably the queen mother. So what I'm suspecting probably happened is when the king had started his meltdown, somebody slipped out the side door and ran and got mom and said, basically, you need to come calm this kid down because things are not good. So the queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banqueting hall, and the queen declared, O king, live forever. Let not your thoughts alarm you or your color change. So she also sees that he's kind of ashen-faced. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. In the days of your father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers. Now, when it refers to him as your father, this is not your direct father. It is a male ancestor. Nebuchadnezzar was not his biological direct father. The best he could have been was great-grandfather. So your father the king made him chief of the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and astrologers because an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Now at this point, Daniel is an old man. We don't know how old he was when he got there, but Nebuchadnezzar began his reign in 605 BC. And so that's about the time when Daniel would have been taken to Babylon. Belshazzar began his reign in 550 BC. So it's 55 years from the time Nebuchadnezzar began his reign until the time Belshazzar began his reign. And Belshazzar dies in 539 BC. So you got 605 to 539, which is 61 plus 5 or 66 years. It's been at least 66 years since Daniel was brought from Israel to Babylon. And as I said, we don't have any idea how old a young man he was when he was brought. So it's 66 plus something at this point in his life. Verse 13. Then Daniel was brought in before the king. The king answered and said to Daniel, "You are that Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah. I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you, that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. Now the wise men, the enchanters, have been brought in before me to read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation of the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretations and solve problems. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler in the kingdom." Then Daniel answered and said to the king, "Let your gifts be for yourselves and give your rewards to another," which is to say, I don't want your trinkets, O king. Now, I don't know whether Daniel has real quick read the thing as he walked in and knows that tonight's the last night of his reign and he's not going to be able to make good on this promise, or whether it's sort of in the same vein as when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are told to fall down and worship the idol, and they basically say, "This is none of your business, O king, and we're not going to worship your idol, and furthermore, you and the horse you rode in on." Very, very starchy answer. This is not a polite answer. Daniel has been a player in the Babylonian Empire for decades. It could also very well be that he just doesn't care for this little snot. Knows he's a little snot, doesn't care for him, and basically doesn't give him just a whole lot of respect. It could also be something like that. I don't know. But the answer is, O king, keep your trinkets. Don't bother me with that. And again, that's really rude, especially when it's a king that's trying to be magnanimous in front of everybody. For you then to say, "No, I'm not interested in your stuff." The least you could do is accept it and take it out and pawn it the next day. But you don't refuse it in front of everybody. The whole point is that Daniel is not impressed by Belshazzar. Furthermore, remember Daniel was basically the regent in Babylon during Nebuchadnezzar's unfortunate time when he was out on his hands and knees grazing in the field. And so the fact that Daniel was not invited to this feast also says something. From all of this, I sort of put together a story of things are not really happy between Belteshazzar and Belshazzar, Daniel and Belshazzar. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And again, this is sort of like, hey, listen, punk, I'll tell you where you came from, and I'll tell you where I was when you before you started, while you were still wearing diapers. I mean, again, it's that kind of a conversation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty, and because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed, and whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up, and whom he would, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly, he was brought down from his kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind, and his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdoms of mankind and sets over it whom he will. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. This is not a conciliatory speech. The queen mother, when she came in, started off with, oh, king, live forever. Daniel doesn't do any of that. You get the impression that he's not impressed with this little punk, saw him in diapers, and doesn't much care. 23. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this, but you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze and iron, of wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. But the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your days, you have not honored. And again, I would suggest to you it is more than simply not honoring God. He has exalted his own gods above God, and this drunken bit with the temple vessels is very much intended to be, my gods are greater than any of your gods, and I don't have to worry about your gods. Verse 24, then from his presence, him being God, then from his presence the hand was sent, and this writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Perez, the kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. And Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple and a chain of gold was put around his neck. And a proclamation was made about him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom, which has limited shelf life at this point. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Now let's stop a second and do some history. There is no secular record of a Darius the Mede. The only place that he shows up is here in Scripture and in the works of Josephus. There are some thoughts about who he might have been. The first thought is a guy named of Astyages, who was the commander of the army that took Babylon. And he died within a week. He took the place over, became military commander over the place, and within a week he died. It's possible that that's who's being spoken of, because he would have, you know, issued decrees and done all sorts of stuff to set things in order and so forth. And the idea that the kingdom was given to him, which is what Scripture says, doesn't indicate that he took it. So it sort of indicates somebody else put him in that position. So that would certainly fit with it being the commander. The other possibility is it's Cyrus the Great, who was in fact the king at that time. And then the third possibility is there is a Darius who was the king of Persia later on, but he is several generations later. Cyrus, by the way, is the king, and you'll see in a minute that Daniel is going to serve Cyrus. One of the things that's come up periodically, and it's in the rabbinic writings, and I think you had it in the companion Bible, Ray, is that Cyrus is thought to have been the grandson of Esther. And according to the secular history of Babylon, Xerxes is yet four generations in the future. So you have Belshazzar, then Cyrus II, then Cambyses, then Darius I, then Xerxes. And he's the guy that was consorting with Esther, according to scripture. So that's several generations down the line. The other thing that I find persuasive, I guess, is Esther and Daniel don't talk about each other. Esther is never mentioned in the book of Daniel and vice versa. So, as I say, there are lots of rabbinic sources that say that. Bullinger says that, so that is certainly credible, but secular stuff that I am looking at indicates that Xerxes is several generations yet in the future. Verse 6, or chapter 6, I'm sorry. It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be throughout the whole kingdom, and over them three presidents, of whom Daniel was one, to whom these satraps should give account, so that the king might suffer no loss. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. Then the president and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. Darius, I am suspecting, is probably basically putting a lot of the same people in place that were there before. The idea being they know where everything is. They know where the bodies are. Sometimes literally, I'm sure. But they know the area, and the fact that he takes Daniel and puts him as one of the top guys, again, I'm surmising, this is not in the scripture, so you don't have to buy it if you don't like it, I'm surmising that he asks around and says, who can be trusted here? And one of the answers that comes up is Daniel. But, you know, the new king comes in, and I think he would be foolish not to figure out who had some talent in the previous staff and make use of him. And that's what I think is happening. So anyway, Daniel has been elevated, and very much in the same way as happened with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he immediately gets plotted against by the other power brokers in the kingdom. So that down to verse 4. And the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom. But they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, we shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God. The idea is they've sort of, in modern Washington terms, they've appointed a special prosecutor, and they're looking for some inconsistency in his testimony so that they can send him to jail for 6 years. Verse 6. Then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, O King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Based on this, I am assuming this is really early in his reign. Having been a staff guy, one of the things you learn is when a new guy comes in, you can very often slip all sorts of stuff in there really quickly before he learns what's going on. That's sort of what's going on here, and so I'm inferring two things. Thing one is he's new, and thing two, he doesn't have a lot of experience. Because if he had been running his own kingdom for any length of time, he would very quickly have recognized that something was up, especially when his number one counselor wasn't in the meeting. I'm assuming that's what's going on. You know, these guys come to him and say, hey, king, We want to cement your rulership here. We want to make sure that everybody knows that you're the king. So what we're going to do is we're going to proclaim that everybody has to bow down and worship you and make petition before you for the next 30 days. And that'll get everybody in the habit of you being the top dog. That's sort of what's going on there. He, being a new guy, says, oh, that's true, cool, signs off on it. Verse 8, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees three times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. And again, this is exactly the same situation as happened with the three young men. As I said when we went through that, it was my belief that those guys were not out in the middle of the town square saying, to heck with you and everything else, O king. They were simply not bowing down and they were worshiping their own God somewhere else. They weren't making a big deal. Somebody had to have ratted them out, as will happen here with Daniel. Daniel's not making a big deal of that. He's just doing what he has done every day of his life. He's going up to the second floor of his house, windows open toward Jerusalem. He's praying three times a day. He has not changed anything. Since it is something he has done every day, they know then that they will be able to trap him or catch him doing this. Again, this is all clearly a setup. He makes no effort to hide it, but it's also not in your face. In other words, he's not out there openly defying the king. He is simply continuing to do what he has always done. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. So came, in other words, they plotted to catch him. Then they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Then they answered and said before the king, Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed. In other words, the king at this point realizes he's been mousetrapped and he is not pleased. When it says much distressed, I mean, this is Bible speak to say he was really ticked. Then the king, when he heard these words, was much distressed and set his mind to deliver Daniel. And he labored until the sun went down to rescue him. By the way, what he's doing is he is consulting with lawyers. Is there some weasel way in here that we can get out of throwing Daniel into the lion's den? That's what's going on. At this point, it's not that he's praying. He'll do that the next night. But at this point, he's simply trying to find a loophole. 15, then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or ordinance that the king establishes can be changed. And again, this is, hey, king, if you want to stay king, you need to make sure that you obey your own laws, is basically what that says. In other words, you get to make the laws, but once you make them, you got to follow them. 16, then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. Notice, the king does not try and negotiate with Daniel. Remember, when Nebuchadnezzar was confronted with the same situation, what he did is he brought the three young men in and says, all right, guys, come on. Let's bow down before this and we can make this all go away. Darius doesn't even try that. He simply has Daniel thrown straight into the lion's den because I think he knows Daniel isn't going to play. Then the king commanded, and Daniel was brought and cast into the den of lions. The king declared to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet and with his signet of his lords, that nothing might be changed concerning Daniel. Now, I will make a guess. I don't think that he is trying to save Daniel from the lions. I think he's trying to save Daniel from somebody going in there and making sure Daniel is dead. I'm guessing. Because I am also expecting that the story of the three Hebrew men in the furnace is known. So the idea that their God might deliver them is certainly on the table. Darius, in fact, prays for that. So there's no reason to seal that thing unless you're expecting that someone may tamper with it. And so who is likely to tamper with it? Somebody who wants to go in there and make sure that the lions are sufficiently hungry. If you're sure the lions are going to do their job, there's no reason to seal that. The only reason you seal it is to make sure nobody goes in and messes with anything. Verse 18. Then the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting. No diversions were brought to him, and sleep fled from him. Then at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. The deal here is, the sentence is, you got to be thrown into the lion's den. The sentence is not that you got to be consumed. So once Daniel has been thrown in there and the sentence has been carried out, and at that point, if Daniel is still alive, hey, God delivered him. And what can we do? We did our best. We followed the law. And that's sort of the attitude here. So at the break of day, the king arose and went in haste to the den of lions. As he came near to the den where Daniel was, he cried out in a tone of anguish. The king declared to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. Now notice, this is a formal mode of address, very different than what he addressed Belshazzar. So Daniel is at this point not upset with Darius and respects Darius. So he's treating him as, I mean, think about it for a second. Here you got these three Hebrews that people keep trying to kill, and they can't get the job done. So there's a possibility that these Hebrews can start doing this to the king. You want to take another shot at me, king? Huh? 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 You know, that kind of thing. And, you know, they might be forgiven if they were to do something like that. But Daniel doesn't. Daniel, you know, recognizes the king has been mousetrapped, recognizes the king didn't want to do this, and treats him with the utmost respect and is going to continue to serve him. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm. So again, what he's saying here is, I'm not disrespecting you, O king. I'm not doing anything in your face. I'm not going to worship your God or worship you, but again, I'm a loyal member of your kingdom. Verse 23, then the king was exceedingly glad and commanded that Daniel be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no kind of harm was found on him because he had trusted in his God. And the king commanded, and those men who had maliciously accused Daniel were bound and cast into the den of lions, they, their children, and their wives. And before they reached the bottom of the den, the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces. So the king is not pleased at having been mousetrapped. And I sort of think that even if Daniel had been consumed, had become lion chow, that was going to be the fate of these guys. Because making a fool out of the king is not a good career move. Even if you happen to get your rival taken out, he's never going to trust you. There just isn't any way, given the character of Darius, that this was going to come out well for the people who were plotting against Daniel. Darius is no softy. I mean, you read his distress and his behavior with respect to Daniel, and you might come to the conclusion that perhaps the guy was a softy. That is not the case. he's not a Babylonian. He's a Persian or a Mede. He has to establish his authority. That was the whole purpose of this 30-day worship period, was to establish his authority. And you know, if you can't do it one way, you'll do it another. The way he did it is he winds up wiping out the whole staff there. Verse 25. Then King Darius wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, "Peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in all my royal dominion, people are to tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, enduring forever. His kingdom shall never be destroyed, and his dominion shall be to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. He who has saved Daniel from the power of the lions." So this Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So he continues to be a member of the top staff, I would imagine probably until his death, or very shortly there before. Would somebody like to close in prayer?